supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. When it comes to sex offenders targeting children, the phrase, lock them up and throw away the key, summarizes what many, maybe most, people feel. Over the last decade, controls and supervision of paroled offenders have become increasingly strict, and sex offenders may well be the most ostracized criminals in our society. But what do we really know about them? Who are they really? And what happens to their victims in the long term? And can they be treated? Well, the answers may surprise you on many levels. Today we'll talk about sex offenders targeting children and the impact on their victims. We'll hear from a therapist who works with victims and offenders and a law enforcement official who supervises parolees in New Jersey. But first, this year, Philadelphia theater goers were introduced to Love, Jerry, a play that delves into the family life and feelings of a pedophile. The play stirred quite a controversy. Mike and Scott has this story.
We think of them as the scary man in the park, the stranger offering candy, the terrifying face on a sex offender registry. But who are pedophiles really? Chris Kirchner from the Philadelphia Children's Alliance says the answer is often much closer to home.
Almost all of the cases, the largest percentage of the cases that we see, the child knows the alleged offender, and it's often a family member, a parent, an uncle, an aunt, it could be a cousin, it could be a sibling. About a quarter of the cases that we see involve juvenile offenders.
A play called Love, Jerry, recently performed by Philadelphia's Nice People Theater Company, takes audiences inside a family torn apart by child sexual abuse. When Mike, his wife Kate, and their 8-year-old son Andy move in with Mike's brother Jerry, everybody seems happy.
A toast to my stupid brother, his gorgeous wife, and my beautiful nephew Andy, who looks just like me.
But the good vibe doesn't last. Jerry, who's shy and isolated, was sexually abused by his uncle as a child and is sexually attracted to children. He's ultimately caught abusing Andy. His brother, Mike, must now decide if he'll try to help Jerry as he undergoes treatment.
He's my brother.
Andy's your son.
He's got nobody else in his life.
Yes, but you do, and if you stand by him, you'll be betraying us.
The play takes audiences uncomfortably close to the predator, inviting compassion while making clear that his acts are appalling. After reading the play, co-artistic director of the Nice People Theater Company, Miriam White, had mixed reactions.
I think we were 75% excited and 25% terrified.
Excited, says White, about the play's depth and humanity, but terrified of touching a taboo. Playwright Megan Gogarty says her intention in writing Love, Jerry was not to make excuses for pedophiles, but rather to open up a conversation and dispel dangerous myths.
By not being honest and face the facts about this issue and who these people are, by painting them as monsters and boogeymen rather than flesh and blood people, it feeds into this cycle of denial that allows us to close our eyes to something that makes us uncomfortable, which, in my view, makes children less safe.
Dr. Barry Zachary of the Joseph J. Peters Institute in Philadelphia treats pedophiles. He says another myth is that these sexual predators inevitably will offend again and again.
The rates of recidivism are far lower than commonly believed or stated in the media. So I think there's a huge misconception about how often individuals with sexual offenses reoffend.
Zachary says up to 25% of child sexual offenders commit abuse again. He also says that treatment, usually a mixture of individual and group therapy, is effective for the majority of offenders, especially in getting them to monitor and control their behaviors. Family ties and social support are crucial for treatment to succeed, says Zachary. But that's what many pedophiles lack, even before their offense.
So once they're caught, I think you can imagine they lose friends, they lose family, and in a very rapid way, they lose all the kinds of social supports that they may have had, even in a limited way. And that has a tremendous, tremendous impact on them, negatively.
The title of the play, Love Jerry, is meant as a question. Watching the play, you find yourself grappling with the choice faced by Jerry's brother Mike. Could you feel compassion for a sex offender, or even provide support?
That was WHYY's behavioral health reporter Mike and Scott with a report on Love Jerry, a play by Megan Gagherty. We'll explore the issue raised by the play and much more during this hour. My guests are Ken Singer and Captain Steve Tallard. Singer is a clinical social worker who treats both sexual abusers and the abused. He's the author of Evicting the Perpetrator, A Male Survivor's Guide to Recovery from Childhood Sexual Abuse. Welcome to the show, Steve, Ken.
Thank you, Dan.
And we're joined here in the studio by Captain Steve Tallard. He's with the New Jersey Division of Parole, where he heads the Sex Offender Management Unit for Southern New Jersey. Captain Tallard, welcome to the
Thank
show.
You.
And, of course, we want to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. We want to hear if you've got an opinion. Moreover, we want to hear if you've got experience either way with childhood sexual abuse. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Ken, lots of issues come up with this topic, and especially with that piece Mike and Scott put together. But I want to start with numbers. Every time I revisit this topic, the numbers I hear is 1 in 3 girls, 1 in 6 boys have been sexually abused sometime in their lifetime. Is that number true, and is that number static? Has it always been that way?
Well, I think it's been fairly consistent, and it varies from 1 to 3, 1 to 4 girls, 1 to 6, 1 to 7, 1 to 8 boys. And that's based on a lot of research that's been done over the last 20, 30 years.
And it hasn't changed?
No, it's been pretty consistent. I think the only thing that's changed has been some of the issues around the offenders who claim to be victimized. That seems to be the biggest change in the numbers.
Well, one wonders if this has been the same for centuries.
Probably has. I mean, people have talked about sexual interest and activities with children since time immemorial, so it's nothing new.
Well, this show's been on the air now for about 10 minutes, and we have said on 3 different occasions that most children know their perpetrators. So I wonder why it's so common that the majority of perpetrators are, let's start with family members.
Well, I think it probably has a lot to do with access. The problem with the stranger danger myth is that people put a lot of energy and caution into telling kids to watch out for strangers, to be hear about parents sitting with the kids at the school bus stops, even behind gated communities, because they fear this stranger is going to snatch their child off the streets and do something terrible to them. And the reality is, it's the people that the child has access to, or that have access to the child, people in the home, people who have legitimate interactions with the child through school or outside leisure activities like scouting or church-related activities. So the child knows and presumably trusts this person. And remember that for many, many, many years, parents have said, listen to adults, obey the adults, and that sort of thing. So in some ways, parents can make it easier for children to be victimized.
So I want to come back to this narrow focused question, and that is family members.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about family members? Why is it so common within families? What does that tell us about family dynamics, our own psychology?
Well, I think you have to look at, you know, who the perpetrator is in these situations. When I've been dealing with adolescent and adult offenders for over 30 years, and ditto with male survivors. And with adolescents, oftentimes you've got the older adolescent who has the access, may even share a room with the victim, so the accessibility is quite easy. With other family members, because they're sharing quarters, they may be seeing the child in states of undress or bathing or whatever it may be, that the person may be stimulated and certainly can have access to the child a lot easier than someone outside the family could.
Hmm. Well, I want to pose this question, I guess, to both of you. We'll start with you, Captain Tallard. This play we just heard from, playwright Megan Gagherty, says that she created the character Jerry, an average guy who's loved by friends and family, in order to help people understand that sexual abusers of children are more often flesh and blood regular humans than most of us would care to know about. We choose almost to see these people as monster. What are your thoughts about the way she portrayed Jerry?
Well, we certainly see in our caseloads in New Jersey, Jerry's kind of situation existing in the caseloads. But it's not representative of kind of the entire gamut of family members who have offended against, their own family. We see some where there's, absolutely no support systems. In Jerry's case, he had the brother that was supporting him, and we do see that. But we see those with total lack of support. We see those whose family members help to cover up continued behavior by offenders. In other words, they're not good partners with the office, with the law enforcement community and the therapeutic community, in terms of being a partner in the individual's recovery.
You're taking us all over the place. I'm looking for common denominators here, and I'm not finding any in what you're saying about the group you work with, offenders.
There's probably no commonality of the offenders, and that's one of the problems. I think if you walked into one of my offender groups, you would look around the room and say that these guys look like average people. The guy that I get my gas from, who pumps my gas, the guy who is in my bowling club. These folks look basically normal. Very rarely do you see anybody that fits the stereotype. Oh, he looks like a child molester.
We had a caller and we lost the call, and I'll address this to you, Captain Tallard. A family member said, what to do about a family member who's abused a child? Do you report them knowing that their lives could be ruined with Megan's List? Could ruin their lives. Do you report them?
Well, there's certainly a lot of ramifications to reporting, and that's one of the problems with sex offenses in general that don't get reported, is because those ramifications exist, many, many people don't report sex crimes. But one of the things that you have to keep in mind is, I think with incest offenders, is you have fairly high rates of recidivism prior to being caught. After it becomes public, after therapy is involved and law enforcement is involved, incest offenders have one of the lower rates of recidivism, and so there's certainly value to it's going to impact the family in certain regards, but it's also going to have a greater impact on future victimization if it is reported.
Mm. Dan, if I could add to that,
sure.
Most people are mandated reporters. You have to report if you have a suspicion of child abuse. There's not a whole lot of enforcement that if somebody fails to do it, but it is on the law. The other thing is whether or not sexual abuse is always premeditated. So oftentimes people will show certain kinds of behaviors that can raise suspicions of those around them. There's an organization called Stop It Now that has a hotline that people can call anonymously and get help for saying, I don't like the way my brother-in-law is playing with my niece, and it's making me uncomfortable. What can I look for? What can I do about it? What can I say to other people? So prevention is really the name of the game here. You want to stop it before it ever comes out, and going after the ones who have been caught is really an unproductive use or waste of resources.
Hmm. I want to look on the inside here. We've been looking on the outside of offenders. I'll turn back to you, Ken. What goes on the inside? What's it like inside their skin, inside their minds?
Well, there's a lot of what we call cognitive distortions or distorted thinking or thinking errors, and this is how somebody makes it okay to do something they shouldn't do it. And a trivial example of that might be that you consciously are going over the speed limit. You know you're going over the speed limit. You know that there's a penalty in getting caught with fines and insurance increases and possibly of getting to an accident and all that stuff, and yet somehow you make it okay to say, I'm running late for this appointment, or I have a real need to be there fast. We can do it with dieting. We can do it with just about any kind of behavior that we flaunt the rules. And that's pretty much how sexual abusers, they know at some level that what they're doing is not right. And that's why the abuse always or almost always takes place in secrecy. Aside from something like a gang rape or an exhibitionist, you don't do this in front of witnesses. You pick the time and the place where you're going to do it.
Well, certainly, though, you're not comparing, sexual offense with what you and I do.
No, I think that the process that allows us to do something that we should not
but
do.
There's a difference. There's
yeah.
So what is that difference? What is that mechanism?
Sometimes it's a lack of empathy that the person is unable or unwilling or incapable of putting themselves in the other person's place. They've rationalized that being touched down there feels good, so this must feel good to the other person, and therefore I'm really doing him or her a favor. There's a lot of mental gymnastics that abusers do to make it okay to do what they do. But ultimately, they know that what they're doing is wrong.
Captain Tallard, would you agree?
Yeah, I would. And frequently what happens is there's those distortions that take place, and they take place sometimes over long periods of time. And there can even be a battle within, fighting it. And then eventually you reach kind of the perfect storm where access is there, the right mood is there. Perhaps there was a stressor in the family that recently has the thinking process off, and everything kind of comes together at the right moment, and the barrier is now broken down and the offense is committed. Hmm. We frequently see these cognitive distortions that Ken was speaking of with our offenders, and our officers are trained to kind of try to identify them and to deal with treatment people, deal with polygraph, and interrupt that cycle.
I want to ask you both this before we take our break. Is it similar to domestic violence, where after the act is committed, there's great remorse and grief on the part of the perpetrator?
I can respond to that. That the sexual abuse treatment field is fairly new. 30 years when I started doing this, it was in its infancy. And what we did was we utilized the model of domestic violence, what they called the abuse cycle. So that the tension stressors would build up, the person would lash out and commit the domestic violence act, and then afterwards would have regrets and remorse and promise never to do it again, and then would come back to normal. And for a lot of, but not all, but a lot of sexual abusers, that's what the pattern is. So it's a matter of interrupting it and understanding that if you recognize the behaviors and thoughts and feelings that occur before an incident, whether that incident is a domestic violence one or a sexual abuse incident, that you can predict and anticipate and correct and get out of that loop.
Yeah, I would agree with Ken. And I've, for the most part, that's what the pattern of most offenders I see. I've seen some offenders that just seemingly lack the ability for empathy. On the one extreme. But I haven't seen a whole lot on the other extreme where there's just severe remorse. That's not something I frequently come into contact
well,
with.
Well, and I wonder if, well, no, I guess I was wrong. I was going to ask if you're working with a skewed population, but anybody who's committed abuse is going to be in your population.
Yeah, we supervise just under 6,000 sex offenders at this point, and so we pretty much cut across all incomes, all races, all ethnicities.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Well, like I said, we've got to take a break. When we come back, I want to try to understand what childhood sexual abuse is. We know it's not about sex. So I want to understand, I assume it's not about sex. So we want to talk about what it is. We're talking about childhood sexual abuse, who the perpetrators are, really, what is being done, what can be done, what should be done to them and for them, and the same thing with sexual abuse victims. What are we learning about trauma, how to best help them? My guests are Ken Singer. He's a licensed clinical social worker. He's written Evicting the Perpetrator, A Male Survivor's Guide to Recovery from Childhood Sexual Abuse. He counsels both perpetrators and victims. I'm here in the studio with Captain Steve Tallard. He's with the New Jersey Division of Parole and has been for 20 years. He heads the Sex Offender Management Unit in Southern New Jersey. We're going to get to your calls right after the break. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The Mann Center for the Performing Arts supports WHYY and presents the Philadelphia Orchestra's final week at the Mann. On July 26th, it's an all Tchaikovsky program with fireworks. On July 27th, the Mann welcomes Aretha Franklin, accompanied by Condoleezza Rice on piano. And on July 29th, it's Planet Earth Live, with video projections from the BBC TV series, along with the show's original score. Tickets for all Mann shows are available at manncenter.org or 215-893-1999.
On the next Fresh Air, Taming the Sea. Almost half of the fish we eat has been raised on farms, and genetic modification of fish is increasing. We'll talk to Paul Greenberg, author of Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about childhood sexual abuse from both perspectives, the perpetrator and the victim, who they both really are and what can be done to help both. My guests are Captain Steve Tallard. He's with the New Jersey Division of Parole. He heads the Sex Offender Management Unit in South Jersey. Ken Singer's on the telephone. He's a clinical social worker. He's written Evicting the Perpetrator, A Male Survivor's Guide to Recovery from Childhood Sexual Abuse. I had said, gentlemen, before we went to break that I wanted to know what this was really about. We know, and I'll turn to you, Ken, we know that rape is about power as much mm-hmm. as anything else. What about child sexual abuse?
Well, it's not about sex. A colleague of mine said that sexual abuse compared to sex is like getting hit over the head with a frying pan is to cooking. So it's really not about that. There is a lot of power and control that's in there, and it has to be addressed from that. It doesn't fit the model that we have for what a healthy sexual relationship is like.
What is it? Is it about power?
If I had to pick one subject, I think power is it. We all want control in our lives, control of our environment, so that we go from point A to point B. We're not going to have a flat tire or run into an accident. And for a lot of people, just about everybody wants control in their lives. And for some people, that translates being in control of others. And I use the term power to differentiate control from that. So the power they have over a smaller, weaker, more vulnerable person, most sexual abuse is not done with weapons. It's done because of the person's size, authority, position of power, knowledge. It's not a level playing field. So it allows the sexual abuse to take place. And remember, you have to take a look at the wide expression of sexual abuse. Is the motivation of a 19-year-old who has consensual sex with a 15-year-old girlfriend the same as somebody who fondles a sleeping 6-year-old? Probably not.
Captain Tallard, how would you weigh in on that, what the abuse is really about? Is it about power, control?
Well, from what I see and am able to discern, it's... sex offenders, as we've been talking from the beginning, they're just so diverse. And as Ken just pointed out, you have different types of perpetrator and victim relationships, and you have different age differences. And I think it's about different things for different people. I think sometimes, although not often, I think sometimes it actually is about sex. But I would agree that, to pick one thing, that power would be the most.
Our phone lines are lit up, and I really want to get to the phones, but I want to ask you something. You keep talking about this diversity issue, and as a culture, if I can be arrogant enough to speak for the culture, I don't want to know about diversity. I just want to see them one way and do one thing about them. I don't want to see this as a diverse population. What needs to be done to educate me?
Well, I think when I'm speaking of diversity, what I'm talking about is the diversity in their offense patterns.
Right.
And you have different motivations, you have different triggers, you have different deviant sexual arousals, they're like snowflakes, there's no two alike. So when you're managing sex offenders in the community, what you have to do is really have a good, keen understanding of who your offender is. What are their, past histories of cognitive distortions? What is their deviant arousal? And you have to kind of tailor the roadblocks that you're putting up in front of them to that individual person, while at the same time they're dealing in treatment with people like Ken, and the officer has a lot of communication with, back and forth with the therapist. And so they can, as a team, utilize a containment approach, put polygraph in there and sometimes GPS and really put up the right roadblocks that are necessary for that particular offender. And because they're so vastly different, there really is no set, this is what we do for every person.
Yeah, I can't emphasize that enough. This is not a one-size-fits-all kind of situation, and you really have to tailor the supervision, the treatment, to the particular individual.
Let's go to the phones. We'll start with Doug.
Oh, thank you, gentlemen, for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment on my experiences. I'm almost 60 years old, and my sister is 3 years older than me, and we were victims of a very sick, predatory father. Growing up, I didn't realize what was happening. I think it was just the luck of the draw that I was 3 years younger than my sister, and she reached puberty before I did, because I would have been much more victimized than she was. But having said that, it was all about power and control for my father. And he had so much power and control that I didn't realize what was happening almost until my mid-30s, and still until I started thinking about it, and how come my sister is so sick and mentally destroyed now. He was able to destroy her first marriage after she graduated from college. And all of a sudden, in my mid-30s, I started having these flashbacks of trying to figure out how come my sister is so sick, and I'm not as sick as she is. And because I remember she coming back from college before she was married, she stayed at home for about a year, and I had just gotten out of the service, and I was back home for about a year. And during that year, my sister confronted both my mother and my father many times, shouting and screaming matches over the dinner table, and actually stared at my father and said that, "You raped me." And my father had so much control over my mother that they both stared back at my sister and said, "You're suffering from delusions. I think we should take you in for electric shock therapy. Whatever you're talking about never happened." So I'm in the middle trying to figure out what's going on, and then I started having these flashbacks during the mid-30s, and I confronted my father. I said, what could be wrong with my sister? I just can't figure it out. And he would say, "I don't know. She's just very, very sick." But then with these flashbacks, as I was in grade school, later part of grade school, and just going into my freshman year, of course, my sister was getting ready to graduate from high school. I remember with that adjacent bedroom between my sister and I, a constant pounding of her bed two or three times a week. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me, because I also flashed back to remembering my father walking out of the bedroom one time. But he had so much control over my mother that she is to this day still in denial. And what that's done is destroyed my sister. And I tried to...
Go ahead. Is your father still living?
No, he died. Unfortunately, he died in 1986, just before I was able to put it all together.
Why do you say unfortunately he died? How did you feel about his death?
Because he died instantly. You know, he had a heart attack. It wasn't anything prolonging. So we had no chance. I had no chance to redress. No chance to get a last word in with him. Tell him, "I know what you did, I know what happened, and I want to know why. I want to know how come you have so much control."
Do you still want to know?
Oh, yeah. And that's the problem. Because
let's see. I mean, obviously my guests can't address the issue with your father, but I'm sure they have dealt with men who have had that much control and that much denial. So let's take a listen to what both guests have to say, and maybe you can get some of the information you're asking for, okay?
Dan, this is Ken. I think that Doug brings up a couple of really important points. One is that the repression that he went for years without any conscious awareness of what had happened, and that's real common, not just among males, but it's among a lot of survivors, that they just block it, put it out of their mind, compartmentalize it, don't think about it. With males, it's even tougher, because when the perpetrators of the same gender, it just opens the door to all this stuff. Am I gay? Why did this person pick me? There's a reason I think that the male victimization field is more of a specialty. You just can't throw the average male who had been victimized into a group of predominantly females, because there are separate issues that the women did not experience around arousal.
He wants to know, and I want to address this specifically with both of you. He wants to know about his father. How could his father have committed such a heinous act and been so cool throughout his life, even in his denial, been so cool? I'm sure, Captain Tallard, you work with these men. Yes?
Yeah, I'm hard-pressed to find somebody that I can personally think of, because I don't really deal face-to-face with the offenders so much anymore, that kind of fits, the scenario that Doug is talking about. I think that, we see offenders who have children to abuse. That's their purpose of having a child. We see people that target females with children, as relationship partners, and become a step parent, and not targeting not looking for the relationship with the female, but because they have the children, and bringing victims into their web. So we certainly see kind of a level of callousness, you know, towards the offspring. But that's not kind of the most common scenario.
Well,
that
and I would imagine, I mean, what Doug's talking about with his dad is not going to get to your caseload because of the denial. They might, you know, get to Ken's.
Well, caseload. I have to say, I can probably count on one hand in 30-some-odd years of the number of, quote, voluntary offenders who come without...
Well, that's true. That's true.
...law enforcement end of it. This is not something that people are going to seek help voluntarily with. I mentioned Stop It Now before, and one of the goals of that organization is to get people before they offend. And like I said, it's always premeditated. So if somebody feels they're going to do it, has thoughts about doing it, sets plans about doing it, the only thing that's going to stop them is either the victim resistance or somebody's calling them on it or them coming forward themselves. And that doesn't happen all that often.
When we come back from our break, we got to take a break in just a couple of minutes. We're going to talk about victims and what treatments available to them. But before we leave the issue of the internal life of perpetrators, we heard right in the beginning when we heard some of the experts talking about the Play Love Jury, we heard that only 25% reabuse after they're caught, and that abuse, getting caught, is very effective therapy for them. Would you agree that treatment does help, and it does help them and protect the community, and Captain Talbot?
Yeah, I would. I mean, statistics in terms of recidivism rates vary, and they vary by type of sex offender as well. And so it's hard to come up with a single number as to what they were. But, some of the better studies I've seen have shown that more of like an 18-19% recidivism rate overall, dropping to about 11 or 12% if you combine supervision with treatment. Which is for criminal offenders is a relatively low recidivism rate overall, but one of the problems that you have in terms of you can't just take a 10% with treatment recidivism rate and say, okay, we don't have to worry about the offenders as much, because you never really know who it is that you're supervising, because sex offenses are so manipulative and so deceptive and so underreported that the offender that you have in front of you that may have a single offense against their stepdaughter, you know, also has 25 offenses that you're just not aware of against perhaps strangers, you know, friends, you know, children, you know, things of that nature. So with sex offenders, there's always kind of this, you know, backdrop of when any one particular offender, we're not really sure about that offender. We can talk about them in generalities, but when you look at that one particular offender, you know, still waters run deep.
I want to ask you a multiple choice question here.
C.
Well, yeah. C wasn't all of the above. Megan's Law. Does it help you do your job? Does it harm in doing your job? Or C is, can you not comment because you're a law enforcement professional?
Megan's Law is not really directed towards parole, assisting parole in terms of their job and supervision of the offenders. We know who all the sex offenders are, the convicted sex offenders. They're on our caseloads. So Megan's Law, in terms of identifying who the sex offenders are and notification, police departments being aware of it, you know, that's all designed for their benefit. It's not a type of law that's directed to benefit parole supervision.
You. Well, like I said, we've got to take a break, go back to callers, and we want to talk about what happens to victims and what treatments are available for them. The voice you just heard was Captain Steve Tallard. He's with the New Jersey Division of Parole. He has the Sex Offender Management Unit for Southern New Jersey. Ken Singer's on the phone. He's written Evicting the Perpetrator, a Male Survivor Guide to Recovery from Childhood Sexual Abuse, and he treats both victims and offenders. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase Cancer Center Buckingham is fitted out with the latest radiation technology, including a CyberKnife robotic radiosurgery system. Located near Doylestown, Fox Chase Cancer Center Buckingham offers patients convenient access to all the resources of an NCI-designated comprehensive cancer center. Fox Chase Cancer Center Buckingham is in the Heritage Center on Route 263. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase, perfecting the science of compassionate cancer care.
Politics, family, finance, faith. Too often the conversations are limited to who we know. But in our fast-paced world, it's important to know the new faces at the table and the new ideas that could shape our lives. Whether it's immigration, politics, or parenting, we offer real conversation about real issues. Join us as we explore what's beyond the headlines on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about childhood sexual abuse from both perspectives, the perpetrator and the victim. We're with Captain Steve Tallard. He's with the New Jersey Division of Parole. Ken Singer is a social worker who works with both perpetrators and victims. Our number is 888-477-9499. Ken, let's talk about what happens to children who have been sexual abuse victims. I know it's tough to generalize. Certainly not all children develop PTSD, although many develop some symptoms. I hate to use the word, a victim myself by my seventh grade teacher, scout leader, you know, the stereotypical relationship. And, you know, I didn't develop PTSD. I had symptoms of it. I guess 20 years later, I was teaching a course at Hahnemann University, and after class, I started to develop all this anxiety. After class, now you'd think, you know, regular person has it before, but I developed all this anxiety after class, which is when I used to go to his house. But I don't, you know, in my case, I didn't have deep scars from the abuse, so. Who does? How many do get permanently injured? How many develop PTSD? And
you know, that's a difficult statistic. I mean, you know that X number of plane crashes occur a year, and we read about them and hear about them on the news, but we don't hear about all the flights that land and that take off and land successfully. So what we hear about probably more likely are the crash and burn situations where people, you know, develop problems. Some kids are more resilient than others, so that may be a protective factor. I think one of the areas that I'm very interested in this field is what prevents one kid from developing the symptoms that another kid might under similar circumstances. So there's a lot of reasons why they don't, but I think that the problems that do come up for kids, particularly with boys who've been sexually abused, is often monumental. It's unbelievable what some people are going through for years and years and years after the abuse ends.
Is there any way to look at who might be at more risk to be abused?
Well, I mean, just from the standpoint of who is more vulnerable, perpetrators don't read the same books or go to any kind of classes that teach them how to find victims. But in general, kids that are needy, and there's nothing wrong with being needy to need attention or need affection or need a mentor or something like that, a perpetrator can see a kid that, you know, may be more needy, and that kid then becomes more vulnerable. It also may be that just the, you know, the situation in the home, is it a chaotic home? Is there alcoholism or substance abuse or promiscuity? Is there exposure to pornography? There's a lot of factors that can make, you know, one kid more vulnerable than another.
Let's talk about treatment. What does treatment look like? You talked about a 5-point, 5-part letter.
Yeah, that's part of the process. I don't tell people that they should disclose or confront their perpetrator, but if they do, the 5-part letter is a vehicle, and it's goal based. So if you're going to disclose, who am I going to disclose to? Why am I going to disclose? Where, when, and how am I going to disclose? The same thing with the confrontation. I tell people to use a letter format rather than do it in person or over the phone, because it's too easy to fall back into the old communication pattern. So if you were abused when you were 12 years old and you're now 40 and you're confronting your perpetrator, it's not unlikely for you to revert back to that 12-year-old kid again emotionally. So it puts you at a disadvantage. The letter provides a vehicle to get your point across to the perpetrator that you know what he did. This is how it's affected your life. This is how you feel about what he did. This is how you feel about him. And this is what you want him to do about it.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Chris on the line, who's from the Children's Alliance. Hi, Chris.
Yes, hi. I am the director of an agency that coordinates the investigation of child sexual abuse in Philadelphia. And I know you're talking about what victims need, and our agency really works to coordinate child welfare, law enforcement, prosecution, and medical and mental health services. I think one thing that we owe victims when they do get the courage to disclose, we owe them a safe and supportive process. Often it's very hard for them to talk about what happened and be interviewed about that. And that's the first step. We need to let kids know that we're going to listen to them, that there's a safe environment. And then once they're able to talk about what happened, I think it's
Can I interrupt you?
Sure.
How do you make an environment safe? What do you do?
Well, we don't allow offenders in the facility. It's child-friendly. We have activities for various ages. We have one specialist who interviews the child, while others who need to interview the child watch through a closed-circuit TV or a one-way mirror, so that they're only questioned by one person. If they have to be interviewed more than once, it's by the same person who builds some rapport with them, who allows them to take their time, who allows them to draw what happened. And so the police officer, the child welfare social worker, they're in another room. So we try to minimize the number of times children have to talk about what happened. We offer support services for their what we call the non-offending caregiver. They have to be brought to our program by a caregiver who is supportive, and then we try to support that caregiver as well to answer their questions. Families are often very nervous about the intervention, and I think one of the worst things that can happen is kids get the courage to disclose, and then they get intimidated by the response.
Tell us how someone can find the Children's Alliance.
It's www.philadelphiachildrensalliance.org, or you can Google Philadelphia Children's Alliance and find us easily. We can also connect people with the long-term treatment agencies in Philadelphia that specialize in working with child sexual abuse victims.
Well, it's good to know that you're out there, and it's good to know that those agencies are out there. Chris, thanks so much for
thank you
for calling.
Thank you.
I want to come back to you, Ken. We know a good deal about childhood trauma, but is there something unique about sexual trauma?
Well, speaking for the male, the male victims, because the perpetrators are more often male than female, although we're finding that a lot more abuse by females has been going unreported, and it's at a higher number than the arrest records would show. It introduces so many problems for a young boy, young adolescent, in terms of intimacy. I don't mean sexual intimacy, but just having an intimate, caring, sharing relationship with another person. It deals with trust factors. It deals with questions about sexual orientation, because males are going to show arousal, whereas females may be aroused, but they're not going to show it. So it adds another layer of, am I gay? Is this going to make me gay? Is this going to make me a perpetrator? What? And by the way, that a real important point to bring out is that if a boy is abused, he's not going to become a perpetrator, even though that a number of perpetrators claim victimization status. It doesn't make one a perpetrator. It's not like being bit by the vampire.
Yeah, when we spoke with you before the show, Captain Tallard, you said something very similar, that a lot of people on your list are going to say they were abused as children, but that's not necessarily true, that they're looking for an easier sentence.
Yeah, I think that by claiming, you know, that you were abused yourselves, I think that they in effect, try to turn themselves from a perpetrator into a victim, and justify their actions. It couldn't be helped. And polygraph studies have shown that most people that do claim victimization, most perpetrators that do claim victimization, really weren't.
We've only got a minute or so left, Ken, but I want to double back to something you talked about way back in early part of the show about, there's something that goes on in our brains where they distort things in similar ways to us. These days younger and younger girls are getting sexualized with their clothes and their behaviors and, clothing commercials with half-naked prepubescent girls. Does this make matters worse? What is it about our mentality that likes to sexualize girls younger and younger?
Well, yeah, it's not just girls, it's boys, too. I think the field is knocking on the door of the whole phenomenon of internet pornography, and not just child pornography or child sexual abuse images, as the preferred term is today, but just this incredible stimulation. When I'm about your age, Dan, and when we were kids, if we got a hold of a Playboy magazine, it took a little bit of effort, but that was the extent of it. Nothing that was really as raunchy as what's out there today. You go on the internet and Google sex, and you get probably more reference than anything else.
And you get that. And you get that at any age. Unfortunately, we are out of time, and there's so much more that needs to be discussed. I want to thank you both so much for joining us on today's show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. And I'll see you, Ken.
Take care, Steve. Bye.
Old friends I had here.
Well, we work with parole very closely. It's a very important relationship between clinicians and the people these guys.
That's good to know. Well, my guests, the voice you just heard was Ken Singer. He's a social worker, works with perpetrators and victims, and his most recent book is called Evicting the Perpetrator. We also heard earlier from Captain Steve Tallard. He's with the New Jersey Division of Parole, where he heads the Sex Offender Management Unit for South Jersey. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll take a look at a Philadelphia program that provides support and services for young victims of violence. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org. Or you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content here at WHYY. Mike and Scott is our executive producer, in addition to being the behavioral health reporter. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Evan Pliss is our intern. I'm Dan Gottlieb, the host. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Tell me.